Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We are just 1 week away from Election Day. A study by the Pew Center on the States in 2010 found that 79% of the 217 million people eligible to vote in the U.S. had registered. That's 135 million. And of those, 90 million cast ballots. So we've got 217 million people eligible to vote. 90 million actually voted. The San Jose Mercury News recently compiled a few facts about voting. According to a report by the Brennan Center for Justice, the U.S. is one of the few countries to make voters entirely responsible for registering. In Canada, voters are added to the rolls when they turn 18 automatically. Arizona led the way in 2002 with an online voter registration program. Today, over 70% of all registrations in that state were done online. A dozen other states have followed suit, including California for the first time, Colorado, New York, and Ohio. And then in July, Washington became the first state in the country to allow voters to register through a Facebook app. The app pulls your name and date of birth from your profile and then asks for information from a driver's license or a state ID. And then we have a study by professors at UC Irvine and Virginia Tech that found that allowing voters to register on Election Day boosts turnout by about 7 percentage points, but only 8 states allow for same-day registration. California's new same-day registration law will not be implemented in time for this November's election. So who is voting this year, and which barriers of voting could affect election results in states across the country? Voter suppression laws have received so much media attention in the last couple of weeks, and we are now hearing about concerns about electronic voting. Over at Salon, they've got a story called Romney Linked Voting Machine Company to Count Votes in Ohio, and then the Christian Science Monitor has a recent report called E-Voting Puts Vote Accuracy at Risk in 4 key states. So are you planning to vote? Why or why not? And what do you think is the best way to vote to ensure your vote is actually being counted? Today we are joined by Lee Rowland, counsel for the Brennan Center for Justice's Democracy Program. He works on community-based voter registration modernization, and restoring the right to vote to individuals with past criminal convictions. Hi, Lee. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I am a woman, as you'll now hear.
Oh, I said he. I'm sorry. She. Hi, Lee.
No problem.
And where are you located?
The Brennan Center is located in New York City. We're surviving out the storm. I'm working from home today.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I wasn't.
And we are part of NYU Law School.
I wasn't sure if you were joining us from New York or D.C. So how are you doing in New York?
Well, you know, I was very fortunate. It was, you know, a scary storm, but not much more than soggy for us. We're in non-coastal Brooklyn, but pretty much everywhere around us is a scene of relative devastation and flooding, and all of the public transit is down, which for New York basically means that the city that never sleeps has to sleep a little bit without folks being able to get across the river. So we're doing our best to keep it going, especially a week out from Election Day, of course, to make sure that election protection hotlines are running smoothly and that we continue to monitor what's going on in the states and make sure we have an election that's as smoothly run as possible.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you're okay. And I was looking at the photos and reading articles last night. It's all so surreal. And I just want to let listeners know that we will cover the storm on Friday. We'll talk about media coverage. There are so many angles. And one that I heard this morning from Think Progress is that there's obviously so much coverage of Hurricane Sandy, but hardly any mention of climate change or global warming. So we'll be sure to talk about that on Friday. We're also joined today by Peter Levine. He is the Lincoln Feeling Professor of Citizenship and Public Affairs and Director of CIRCLE, the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement. He is the author of the forthcoming book, We Are the Ones We Have Been Waiting For, The Philosophy and Practice of Civic Renewal. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, and thanks for doing that long intro.
Oh, well, thank you. I just found these facts at the San Jose Merc and thought they were so fascinating. We're also joined by Tova Andrea Wang. She's Senior Democracy Fellow at Demos, a fellow at the Century Foundation, and a consultant to organizations working to improve democracy around the world. She is the author of The Politics of Voter Suppression, Defending and Expanding Americans' Right to Vote. Her work primarily focuses on voting rights and increasing political engagement, especially among immigrants, communities of color, and the poor. Hi, Tova. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. So I'm always fascinated by looking at who actually votes, and it's amazing to think that 217 million people are eligible to vote in the U.S. About 135 million are actually registered, and then in 2010, 90 million ballots were cast. And so if you add just, what, 5 or 10%? I mean, this can completely change the country. So, Lee, why don't we start off with you? Why do you think so few people actually vote in this country?
Well, there's no question that this is really the great crisis of our democracy. I mean, when you hear those numbers, you hear, you know, we have barely a half of the eligible population registered to vote and actually voting, even in presidential election years. And I think you got at it a little bit in your introduction, which is, frankly, we still have a pretty antiquated voter registration and voting process in this country. It's localized. Most of our processes date back from the 18th century, and though they were great processes then, we really haven't followed through and updating them like we have. Now, you listed some of the states that are trying to meet voters where they are, whether it's Washington offering voter registration on Facebook or offering new ways to expand access to voting, such as early voting and same-day registration, to take some of that burden off the individual voter to jump through all those hoops. And the unfortunate reality is that although that is the true crisis in our democracy, over the last 2 years, we've seen a lot of state legislatures, unfortunately, trying to make it even harder to register and vote. And so many states have unfortunately gone the wrong way. We are seeing some real points of light on the horizon in states that are trying to modernize their voter systems, to expand opportunities, expand access for voters and to register to vote. And that's where we need to focus our energies. Those are policies we support. We, you know, help draft model bills that help other states bring their election systems into the 21st century. And that's the path ahead of us if we really want to cure what's rotten in our democracy, which is a really abysmally low turnout and registration rates.
And we will talk about voter suppression, which the Brennan Center has followed so closely, in just a couple of minutes. But Peter, I wanted to get you to add to that. Why do you think registration is so low? We often hear about apathy and then also disenfranchisement. How do you explain this?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I agree with the premise. In fact, our turnout is usually the worst in the world among actual democracies, that functioning democracies. And it's also dramatically lower than it was in the early part of the 20th century if you count just white men. But that's in a way a fair comparison. If you look at white men then and white men now, they're much less likely to vote. So we obviously have a problem and something that we should be able to address. And I agree about all the concerns about the antiquated registration system and just the fact that almost all the burden to figure it out is on the individual and to navigate it. And, you know, what business would, for example, require you to register for a service 30 days in advance, not advertise how to do it, and then wait 30 days and then within a few hour window get the service? I mean, they would do that if they had a very scarce good, but if it's a free thing that everybody's supposed to get, who would do that? I would like to broaden the discussion a little, though, because I don't think it's only about the ease or complication of the voting system. You know, there are other factors, too. A lot of elections, many elections in the United States are not competitive at all. That's on purpose. Mm. They're gerrymandered districts, so certainly turnout is much higher in battleground states and swing congressional districts than it is in uncompetitive districts. And then people are either disempowered or lack information and knowledge, and those are two huge preconditions. And those things can also, instead of just complaining about that, we can actually do something about those.
Well, and this is interesting because I know that in San Francisco, when we're not voting for a president, for example, the rate is pathetic. I mean, we're getting 20-25%. And I'm even hearing from so many friends saying, all right, we've got 11. Well, they don't even know how many props are on the ballot, to tell you the truth. But we've got 11 in California. We have a number just in the city of San Francisco. And they're calling me saying, well, I know you talk about this every day on the radio. How should I vote? And I'm thinking, I mean, this is really sad, but this is what I hear on a regular basis.
On the other hand, you're being spared by the enormous hurricane force of political advertisements, right?
Right. Well, we're sort of spared. I'm getting a lot of paper from all of the candidates. I don't have a television anymore, so I don't know what's going on television, but I'm sure there's so many ads for all of the propositions. And then the swing states, of course, you're being totally inundated. And Tova, what would you add to that, just about why so few people vote in the U.S.?
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you for raising that as the first question of this conversation, because having done a number of interviews now, you are the only one to actually start the conversation by talking about what the real problem is with our voting system in America today, which is that not enough people are participating. Most of the conversation that we've been having over the last several months about the voting system has been this false debate about voter fraud and restrictive measures that are being put in place in response to these bogus claims of election fraud. So that really is the problem, not enough people participating. And I don't think that we can get by without acknowledging some of the social and cultural factors that are going on here. People are incredibly cynical. A lot of people are just completely disengaged. There's very little trust in government institutions and in politicians. And frankly, I mean, you know, that's understandable these days, given the state of our politics. That kind of thing is really hard to cut into. But there are structural changes that we can make to the system that actually do make a difference. And you mentioned same-day registration, and I would plug that again. I think same-day registration is the single best reform measure we have to change the structure of the system to increase participation in the states that have it. And I think there are 9 or 10 now, since a couple of states brought it into play in the last year or two. Those states consistently have the highest turnouts of any in the country, several percentage points higher than everybody else. And as you mentioned, researchers have found that if we had same-day registration across the country, the increase in the number of people participating would go up by several percentage points, which represents a whole lot of people.
And so why is this happening? I mean, you hear politicians constantly talk about the U.S., you know, the so-called best democracy in the world. Why is it so hard for people to vote? It's such a no-brainer, things like same-day registration, online registration. We're finally able to do it here in California for the first time to register online.
Well, I mean, you're talking about even, you know, why is it so hard to get measures passed that would make voting easier and more accessible to every segment of the population? We have, in the past several years, not even been able to have those debates in many states because we've been so busy trying to fight laws that actually make all of this worse, that make registration more difficult, that make voting more difficult through restrictions on voter registration drives, through limits on reductions in early voting, of course, the voter ID laws, proof of citizenship in order to register to vote, all these kinds of things meant to make it more difficult. And frankly, you know, those kinds of measures are being passed, particularly in the last couple of years, by Republican-dominated legislatures who see it as in their political interest and their partisan interest to reduce the number of people who are voting. It is a very conscious effort to keep certain groups of people out of the voting process for election gain.
And that is Tova Andrea Wang, Senior Democracy Fellow at Demos, a fellow at the Century Foundation, author of the new book, The Politics of Voter Suppression, Defending and Expanding Americans' Right to Vote. We're also joined by Lee Rowland, counsel for the Brennan Center for Justice's Democracy Program. Peter Levine is author of the forthcoming book, We Are the Ones We Have Been Waiting For, The Philosophy and Practice of Civic Renewal. And we already have full lines, and I haven't given out the phone number, so clearly there's a lot of interest in this issue. And we'll have a line open in a couple minutes at 866-798-8255. And you can also leave a comment or a question on our website, yourcallradio.org, or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Alex in San Francisco. Hi, Alex.
Thank you. I am afraid they're about to do to Obama what they did to Al Gore and by stealing the election. It's hard to believe that Obama was leading by so much throughout the year, and then they said on that first debate was a game changer.
Right.
And because Romney won that debate. The next two debates, they say, oh, those don't count. It's the first one because Obama won the next two. They say that the next two don't count. It's only the first one. that makes a difference. I mean, I don't see that logic. And then they talk of Romney was ridiculing Obama by saying the president is trying to slow the rise of the oceans. And as if that's like a crime.
Mm, yeah, he said that at the Republican National Convention, and the audience laughed.
And look at what's happening right now. The country is devastated. And the election, although this country is supposed to be a land of democracy and all that, they are trying their hardest to make sure people don't vote. Because do you know who they want to vote? Are the people who have a lot to lose, the capitalists. This is why we have capitalism. Capitalists will go through rain or sun or shine or hail to vote. But poor people, they don't either have nothing to lose. They're not going to vote. And that's what they're trying to do.
They own the electronic voting machines, that's for sure. Well, thank you for calling, Alex, and we will get a comment in just a couple minutes. I just want to go through a few callers since we have full lines. Let's hear from Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry. Welcome to the show.
Hi, yes, good morning. I think one reason why people don't vote is that they see very little choice. For example, we have supervisors in San Francisco that, although a lot of people are quite unhappy with them and how they voted, there's no opposition, largely because San Francisco is a one-party state. You have a ridiculous campaign between Phil Ting and Michael Breyer, both Democrats, because of this new open primary regulation that we have. And they go back and forth with these ridiculous claims. So you have about couple pounds of coded stock arriving in your mailbox. It isn't even recyclable and tells you nothing about the candidate. And a lot of it's pretty intellectually insulting. Mm-hmm. And the ballot initiatives are so misleading that it's almost like you need a college course to understand how to vote, because they're very deceptive and not always what they appear to be, such as the one to end the death penalty that actually gives more money to law enforcement and stops people's rights, curtails prisoners' rights to appeal their sentence.
Well, thank you so much, Harry, and we'll get a comment in just a minute. Let's first hear from Andre in San Francisco. Hi, Andre.
Oh, hi. You know, I'm a social activist, and I know there are many reasons why people don't vote that are far-reaching. But I was thinking that, you know, many years ago, McDonald's opened a drive-through window. People in cars could come up, buy what they wanted, and eat it wherever they wanted to do. What about something like that? In crowded urban areas, there must be parking areas that could be opened up near voting machines. There must be some way to get people, you know, off of their lazy butts to get out there and do something that, you know, maybe they think is slightly inconvenient. They want someone else, you know, to take care of their needs for them without even going out of their own way.
Well, thank you. I mean, you can also have an absentee ballot, so you don't even have to leave your home and go through a drive-through to vote, right? It comes to in your mail, and then you send it back. So that's another way to vote. And that's another question I wanted to ask you, Lee. I know you have to leave us in about 5 minutes. How are people voting today, and how have voting patterns changed over the years?
Well, there's no doubt that as states have, you know, brought voting to where voters are, so to speak, that voters have taken advantage of those opportunities. So pretty much every state that we've seen that's introduced online registration has had massive amounts of activity on that new online registration system, and especially in those last hours before the registration deadline. And that's telling you it's really serving a need. They're filling the void that exists in our system because we actually haven't changed our fundamental systems of voter registration and voting in hundreds of years. And states are starting to. In the last few years, we're seeing states expand with options like early voting, no-fault absentee voting, introducing new ways to register, whether that's online, whether it's on Facebook, which is really just fantastic, especially for younger voters, where there's a real participation gap. So the reality is that we could do a lot more. But we know from these laboratories in the states that these types of reforms work. They create flexible systems that absolutely, in the case of something like Election Day registration, increase participation rates, make it easier for voters to participate, and doesn't put that entire burden on their shoulders. So the patterns where we give voters the opportunity to expand and take advantage of those new opportunities, they'll do it. So basically, the patterns we'll see are exactly what we expect to see, which is if we improve our systems, give voters more options, we will get higher registration and participation rates at the end of the day.
And what do you think is the safest way to vote to ensure that your vote is actually counted? Because over at the Brad blog, they follow this very, very closely, and they're not advocates of mail-in voting. In fact, they reported that last month in Cudahy, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, California, it's a small city near Los Angeles, top city officials, including former Mayor David Silva and former city manager Angel Perales, agreed to plead guilty to federal charges of bribery and extortion. They were tampering with mail-in ballots. So what is the best and safest way to vote?
Well, I'm hesitant to say that there is a best or safest way, but I will say that what we can do is to make every way as secure and reliable as possible. And there's clearly a ways to go on absentee balloting. Indeed, much of the fraud that's been found in the system over the past several decades has been in the absentee fraud world. Obviously, there are criminal penalties, but unfortunately haven't deterred instances recently like those you were speaking of and others that have been reported. So that's a real issue. We all want to make sure that we have real elections that represent the will of the people, and we can address that. But in terms of how to make sure that your vote counts and that individuals have confidence that their vote counts, the vast majority of people still actually go in person and cast a ballot. And what we at the Brennan Center have really worked on is making sure that anywhere that's using these machine processes has two critical fail-safes. The first is a voter-verified paper trail. It's an absolute necessity, full stop. And, you know, you had callers talking about the ownership of those machines in swing states like Wisconsin. Fortunately, states like Wisconsin and Florida, since the last major election, have made their paper verified processes more robust because of public demand, because we need that fail-safe to make sure that voters ultimately have confidence that the results of the election are the correct results.
And Lee, let me ask you, since we just have a couple minutes with you, I want to ask you about e-voting. So Salon is reporting that voting machine provider Hart InterCivic will be counting the votes in various counties in the crucial swing states of Ohio and Colorado. And reports of Hart's ties to Romney first surfaced on the Free Press website. That's an Ohio website. They report that a key investor in Hart was HIG Capital, seven of whose directors were former employees of Bain and Company. And then the Christian Science Monitor did an investigation recently and found that in four battleground states, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Florida, and Colorado, glitches in electronic voting machines could produce erroneous tallies that would be difficult to detect. So, I mean, these are not conspiracy websites here. We've got Salon writing about Romney linked to this Ohio voting machine company, and then the Christian Science Monitor doing this investigation. What are your thoughts on these two pieces?
Well, given the system we have right now, you know, take it or leave it, we are stuck with a system where private companies own and operate the machines that run our national elections. Now, could we do something about that? Maybe, but that's a hypothetical that's many, many years off. So what can we do with the system we've got now, assuming that private companies are part of the bargain? You know, I, for one, wouldn't assume that simply because there's a profit motive or, you know, a friendship or a relationship, that that means that that our vote is going to be skewed, that those machines will be tampered with. Because of the makeup of our elections, we can't believe that, but we can have systems in place that make sure that the voters are confident that the results are correct and that if and when those machines have problems, they are immediately reported, they are investigated, and we make sure that no other jurisdiction ever uses that darn machine again.
All right.
And the problem is we don't have that system in place.
And
we
have
no federal body dedicated to that. And
I know
we have fought that tooth and nail.
We have to let you go, and we'll get responses from our guests after the break. Lee Rowland is with the Brennan Center for Justice's Democracy Program. Thanks for joining us.
Rose in the second half of the program in just a moment. Every Tuesday, the Your Call team sends out a weekly email newsletter that helps us all keep up on what's coming up on the program. Gives you resources to let you learn more and to get involved. Subscribe today so you'll know what's coming up and you can submit your questions and comments before the show goes to air. It's free and easy to sign up. Just click the email newsletter link at yourcallradio.org. You can participate in today's show by calling 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK, or send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about the ethics of providing humanitarian aid in conflict zones. We'll have a conversation with Sophie Delaney, Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders. And then on Thursday, we'll talk about the legacy of the American Indian Movement. We will honor the passing of Native activist Russell Means, and we will mark the opening of San Francisco's annual American Indian Film Festival. That's on Thursday. And then Friday, it's our media roundtable. And again, I just want to acknowledge what has happening in the East Coast, one of the worst natural disasters in the history of the United States. So much devastation. We'll be talking about media coverage of that on Friday. Today, we are talking about voting. Who is voting? What are the barriers to voting? And why is it so difficult in a country like the United States to have things like same-day registration or registering online? In the U.S., I didn't really think about this until I read this 9 facts over at the San Jose Merc. A report by the Brennan Center for Justice notes that the United States is one of the few countries to make voters entirely responsible for registering. In Canada, for example, voters are automatically added to the rolls when they turn 18. So what are your thoughts on this? And if you don't vote, what stops you from voting? And why have you made the decision that voting maybe is not for you? The toll-free number, there will be a line open in just a couple minutes, is 866-798-8255. In 2010, 90 million people in the U.S. voted. 217 million are eligible to vote. This could completely change the way the country looks. So what are your thoughts on this? You can leave a comment, yourcallradio.org, or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Peter, I know this isn't your area of expertise, but what are your thoughts on what we are hearing about Romney's connections to e-voting machines and then the possibility that e-voting might make it difficult to really count the votes in these four key states?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you asked Lee because she is more of an expert, but on that question. But I think one way to address it is that trust in the whole electoral system is extremely low, and it's coming from liberals who probably rightly are worried about the private ownership of the machines and so on. It is also coming from lots of conservatives who I think, in addition to the state legislators, who have a self-interest in making it more difficult to vote. A lot of sort of grassroots ordinary conservatives, as shown in polls, think that the system is corrupt too, and have heard about all their lives about corrupt machines, urban political machines and stuff like that. And the truth is, so I don't think they have the empirical evidence on their side, but I do think that the system is a hodgepodge, a mess. It's 20th century at best rather than 21st century. It puts all the burdens on the individual and not on the state. And so I guess the way I would take the question is to say we should think about really different, sort of profoundly different voting systems in which you don't have to pre-register at all, in which the requirement to the obligation to register you falls on the government rather than on the individual, in which there are fail-safe mechanisms, in which it's convenient for everybody.
And in 2004, we heard instances of people pushing the John Kerry button, and then George W. Bush's name came up. And my Fox 8 is now reporting that this is happening in North Carolina, where people pushed the Romney button, and Obama's name came up. And this piece has been shared about 27,000 times. And reading the comments is really interesting. People are saying the system is rigged. You know, why are we even talking about this? But this is coming up in so many counties in North Carolina. And what would you add to this, Tova? And what would you say to people who read these articles and say, you know, this is why I don't take part in the system?
Well, I mean, I understand people's concerns, and they are legitimate. I think that, you know, there is no perfect voting system. There are problems with all of them, and not just the electronic voting machines, the DREs. I think that we, however, have come a long way over the last 10 years, let's say, or certainly since the Florida debacle, where people are pretty savvy about what can go wrong with voting machines, and election administrators have learned a lot more than they probably ever wanted to about computerized voting mechanisms. And so you know, they're more aware now of the things that can go wrong and how to fix them. I would be more concerned about machines malfunctioning and machines breaking down and there being insufficient machines and election administrators having backup plans should that happen, because if these machines do malfunction, you don't want to end up in a situation where you have voters, you know, lining up down the street for hours because, you know, some of the machines malfunction. So I think that's probably a bigger concern. But it does trouble me a little bit how caught up people get in the electronic voting issue. It is a major issue, and I will not deny that whatsoever. But it does distract a little bit from the much more simpler ways that we have actual facts about that ways in which people are being cut out of the system and results of elections potentially being changed as a result that are much more glaring and obvious and based on reality than some of the theories going on around out there. I will say, however, though, it does point to the need for, obviously, conflict of interest rules. There should clearly be no way that someone associated so closely with Romney should be have some investment interest in a voting machine company. And I would also say that we should extend that to elections officials and move towards another aspect of countries around the world that, in terms of what they have in their systems and we don't, which is nonpartisan election administration. The people that are overseeing these machines and that are overseeing the entire process are partisanly elected politicians. And that's a huge problem. And while I don't know that it's going to change anytime soon, I think having people who the voters could trust more to oversee these systems and implement the system would go a long way to restoring some of that trust.
Well, let's see what a voter in North Carolina thinks about the complaints that electronic ballot machines are casting the wrong vote. Let's hear from Julie in North Carolina. Hi, Julie. Welcome to the show.
Hey there.
So have you heard about these complaints? Is this getting a lot of attention in your area?
Actually, I've not heard about that at all, so that was interesting to me. Hmm. And where I live in Asheville in Buncombe County, we don't have we don't have those kinds of ballots. There is an electrical one you can use, or an optical one that you do if you're blind. But that's the only way. Otherwise, it's a paper ballot. So I don't know what counties are using that. But in Buncombe County, that's not what they use. It's all paper, and it's very straightforward. And what I wanted to say was, you know, I come from California. I lived there most of my life and had never heard of same-day voting, had never heard of early voting. And when I moved here 6 years ago, it was shocking to me that you could go and actually register and vote on the same day. And I am now a complete believer in it and think it's an amazing thing. I don't know if they, I mean, we'll see how it works in California, which is a bigger state than North Carolina is. But where it works here, you know, there is you have to register 30 days before if you want to vote on Election Day. That's the same. But early voting is 2 or 3 weeks before the election. This year, it's Monday through Saturday in most places till like 6 o'clock. And on Sunday for two Sundays, it was noon to 6. And you can go, and all of the 10 early voting sites in the county are connected by computer to the central Board of Elections here. So you say your name, they find your name there. They give you, there's like 10 ballots or so in this county, depending on what school boards or whatever boards you're voting for. They find your name, find your ballot, you go and vote, and it's very easy, and you can also register and vote on the same day. So it's a really good system. And I worked as a poll worker in 2008 for 3 weeks and was impressed with how much everybody, the point was to get everyone who wanted to vote to vote if that was possible.
Thank you for that story. And it's good to hear that you're not dealing with these electronic voting machines in your county. Thank you so much for calling in, Julie.
You're welcome. Julie
from North Carolina. And again, she mentioned same-day registration in California. It was just signed by Governor Jerry Brown. And right now, California cuts off voter registration 15 days before the election. Same-day registration will not be implemented until at least 2014. And this was contested along partisan lines, Democrats saying it would encourage more voter participation, Republicans saying it would encourage fraud. So again, we will have same-day registration here in California, but not for another 2 years. And let's go to our next caller, Therese in San Francisco. Hi, Therese. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. I wanted to know why so many minority males were not voting. So I went to three different areas in Richmond, San Francisco, and Oakland. So I'll focus on Richmond. I went to North, Central, and South. Out of the 50, all of them said, I asked them the question, how many of you will vote? All of them said, probably not. Mm. I then asked, why not? All of them said they weren't quite sure how the process worked, and also they thought it would be too confusing. Then out of the 50, 45 said they all had records. That in itself is a problem. After further talking to them about something that I found on the ACLU site, I found out that only four were actually ineligible to vote.
Hmm.
They were still on parole. All of the others just assumed they could not vote because they either had misdemeanors or were still on probation or had been on probation. They honestly did not know that they were able to vote.
Wow.
I told them different places they could go in their areas to vote, and they asked, would there be people there that could help them? I don't know all the answers, so I did the best that I could. I have a program at the Richmond Powell Center called Everyone Deserves a Chance, and I work with young kids who are pretty much referred to me through probation. A lot of them have no idea of their rights. And that, to me, was shocking. So then a lot of them also said that they weren't going to vote because it really didn't matter. It was just one vote. So I told them, imagine 1 million young people, such as yourselves, saying the same thing. That's 1 million people that were needed for the right person to be in office.
Right. And also, when you're talking about Richmond, I'm sure you've got some very important local issues that you're voting on, right?
Yes.
Which will greatly impact these kids. I mean, this is an amazing survey you did, and probably part of the problem, and Tova, I'd love you to respond to this, is that we've got such a hodgepodge of laws. NPR just did an incredible report last week about felons in Florida who have to ask the governor to allow them to vote. And it was amazing to hear the tape of the governor saying, yes, you can, or no, you can't. Most instances, he says no. I mean, you've got like Vermont and Maine allowing prisoners to vote while incarcerated. And then you've got harsh, harsh laws in places like Kentucky, Iowa, Virginia, and Florida.
Yeah, I mean, I am so glad that she raised the issue of felon disenfranchisement. And, you know, thank you for doing what you do. This is something that we really need to talk about more when this election is over, because I can tell you sitting here right now that there are 6 million people in the United States of America who will not be able to vote on Election Day this year because they have a record of a felony conviction sometime in their lives. 4.4 million of those 6 million are out of jail. They have served their time in jail. They have paid their dues, and they are trying to get their lives back together, reintegrate into society, and get back into their communities. And they are denied the very fundamental right to vote. It makes absolutely no sense. It is counterproductive in so many ways. And again, the fact that we have these laws on the books, many of which were enacted 150 years ago, it speaks again to politics. And the other part of the problem is exactly what she identified. Every state has different rules on this. A lot of states make you get through parole and probation before you're allowed to vote again. But nobody tells these people that they have the right to vote or when they have the right to vote. And so all across the country, you have people who are eligible to vote who are never told by their parole officers or anyone else that they can get their voting rights back and how to do so. And speaking of Florida, you mentioned there are over 1 million people in Florida alone who are disenfranchised by their draconian voter felon disenfranchisement law, which in the last 2 years was made even more draconian by the current governor to make it even harder for individuals to regain their rights, because they indeed have to apply to a clemency board, which they can't even begin to do until 5 years after they've completed their sentences. It's really kind of an outrage.
And so is it fair to say that in these states, the governors have the control? Because in 2007, progressive Republican Governor Charlie Crist worked to streamline the restoration of rights for felons. He restored the rights to close to 6,000 felons during his last year in office. But when Rick Scott took office, he reversed that law.
No, that's exactly right. Well, in those two instances, they were done by the governor's executive order. But in some places, it's a matter of passing legislation through the state legislature. In one or two places, such as Virginia, it's actually in the Constitution, and you might need a constitutional amendment. But even in those places, as Charlie Crist did do, he at least streamlined and made it easier the process to regain the rights through this clemency process. Rick Scott has been, you know, fairly singular in coming up with different ways to disenfranchise voters in Florida, along with several other secretaries of states and governors across the country, and it's really quite remarkable.
So we've got 6 million people who do not have the right to vote because of a felony, and we just got an email from Kelly who says, how many states do not allow felons who have served their time, and how many states do allow felons? Do you know, Tova?
Well, you mentioned the two states that allow people to actually vote while they're in jail. Those are the only two. I don't know the exact breakdown of states. You know, it depends if you're on parole, if you're on probation. And then you have the really bad ones like Florida and Iowa and Kentucky that, for all intents and purposes, disenfranchise people for life. They make it so incredibly hard to regain your voting rights. And so, as I said, I hope this is an issue that gets more attention going forward, because while this is a very old issue, as I said, these laws were enacted, you know, as I talk about in the politics of voter suppression, enacted, you know, a very long time ago, and always with a racial and partisan motive in mind. We haven't been talking about them because there have been so many new restrictions this year, but this is a huge issue.
And Peter, what would you add to that? I know that you also focus on young people and voting. What are your thoughts on Teresa's survey of the young African-American men in Richmond who say they're not going to vote?
Yeah, well, a couple things. I mean, this is a great discussion, and the most important issue has been raised, but the caller mentioned that a lot of young people think they can't vote when they can, and that's, of course, a separate problem. And we just released a poll yesterday where we asked people about photo ID requirements and early registration requirements and sort of the key voting laws, and about 40% of young people don't know what those laws are in their own states. So that's a separate problem. I just want to accentuate the positive a little. Well, let me hit one more negative. Well,
sure.
And then I'll end on a positive
okay.
note. The other thing about the ex-felon disenfranchisement laws is that they've been found to actually reduce turnout in communities where there's a lot of people with prison records, even for the people who haven't ever been convicted of a felony, because they probably just reduce the amount of electioneering and campaign mobilization that goes on in those communities. So that's just making a victim out of you in another circle of people. The positive thing I wanted to say was that that caller began by talking that she wanted to talk to minority young men about voting. So I think it's important for people to realize that actually African-American young people have the highest turnout rate of any racial and ethnic group. And that's not just in the Obama era. That began, to put it one way, in the Jesse Jackson era. And so actually there are assets and resources in communities. I mean, there are a lot of people actually doing grassroots get out the vote work, and there are traditions in, especially in the African American community, that are very strong. So, and a lot of people will vote. A lot of more people, of course, will vote in the 2012 election than in the 2010 election, which you've been mentioning. So, I mean, I'm extremely concerned about low turnout, but do want to point out that millions and millions of young people will vote, and that, in fact, young African Americans are likely to vote at a disproportionately high rate.
And that is Peter Levine. He is author of the forthcoming book, We Are the Ones We Have Been Waiting For, The Philosophy and Practice of Civic Renewal. He's also a professor of citizenship and public affairs and director of CIRCLE, the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement, and professor in Tufts University's Tisch College of Citizenship and Public Service. And Tova Andrea Wang is a senior democracy fellow at Demos, author of The Politics of Voter Suppression. We've got just about 8 minutes left, so I just want to go through a couple of emails, because we're getting a lot of emails. We have an email from Matt in Oakland who says, for some time, I've thought that we should have a mandatory voting proposition on the ballot in California, making voting compulsory. I feel like if fewer than 50% of people vote, we don't actually live in a democracy. And Tova, I always think about Australia when these comments
right.
come up, because you are fined if you don't vote in Australia, and they have an incredibly high turnout rate. But then we've got an email from Leslie, who says, although I fully support expanding the ease to register, I'm very concerned about same-day registration. A concerned citizen should be an informed voter. So, interesting comments about this. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, let me take them one at a time. First of all, on the issue of mandatory voting, it has been so interesting. As I've been going around with the book and going to colleges and universities, among other places, the issue of mandatory voting has come up at, like, several of them, and I've been so startled by that because it never really came up in conversation before. So I'm starting to wonder if this is becoming, you know, something that you can actually talk about. It's true that mandatory voting exists in a number of countries, not just Australia, and they have enormous turnout rates. And from the discussions that I've had with people where that system is in place in Latin America, in Europe, and other places, is that it actually makes people become more engaged and become more educated. It's not just because, oh, well, if you don't vote, you know, you might get fined. In a lot of these places, it's actually not all that well enforced. But you do create a culture of engagement by making it mandatory. I don't think it's happening anytime soon in the United States for all sorts of reasons, but it is an interesting topic for conversation at this point. With respect to the second comment, I get this a lot, and I talk a lot about it a lot in the politics of voter suppression. There are people who believe that we shouldn't make it easy to vote, and not everyone should probably vote because, you know, boy, there's that guy, you know, down the street, and he doesn't know anything. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Why should he be able to vote? I think that's a very dangerous road to go down. We have a standard in this country of democracy where we are an inclusive democracy. We don't make people take literacy tests anymore. And, you know, if you are going to say, well, there are some people who should vote and some people who shouldn't because, you know, these people are informed or these people aren't, who is the one who's going to decide that? Who is going to develop that litmus test that's going to decide who is worthy of voting? I don't want to go anywhere near that, and I believe that we live in a country where we welcome everyone into the system, and none of us should feel empowered to pass such judgment on people as to whether they should have the very fundamental right to exercise their right to vote in our democracy.
Well, Peter, you wanted to bring up more positive news, and the Brennan Center reports that since January 2011, 180 bills were introduced in 41 states to suppress the vote. 25 new laws, 2 executive actions were adopted, and these states represented 231 electoral votes, or 85% of the total needed to win the presidency. But the Brennan Center says a couple of months ago, I mean, they were talking about these massive threats to voting rights. They say today the reality is very different and far better. The dramatic national effort to restrict voting rights was met with an equally dramatic pushback by courts, citizens, and the DOJ. And so they basically say it's not as bad as it was just a couple of months ago.
Right. Thanks in part, for large part to them, and also to extremely poorly crafted legislation. I mean, the Texas law is one that I've looked into, and it's just an incredibly amateurish effort. But and I guess I would just say, I think it's important for people, even though we're talking about the problems with voting a week before the election, it's important for people to, and we should worry about those problems, but it's also important for people to realize that, you know, they're actually going to be able to vote if they show up. Their vote's going to be counted. That's not true necessarily in every single case, but it's overwhelmingly true. And I think if we give too negative an impression about the voting system just before an election, we might contribute to the problem.
All right. Well, thank you for those emails. And let's hear next from David in San Francisco. Hi, David.
Yeah, hi. In listening to this, I hadn't heard anything about the scandal that emerged about a month ago. A company called Strategic Allied Consulting and Nathan Sproul. This is the company that was hired by the GOP to work the swing states in doing voter registration. And Nathan Sproul goes back for basically the 2000 election, and in every presidential year he's been essentially registering Democrats and then throwing away their registration. And as I understand it, as Florida, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Colorado have all fired him after paying him millions of dollars this year, but he continues to work because he's changing the company name. And so Strategic Allied Consulting is now Grassroots Outreach LLC or Issue Advocacy Partners. So the idea that the Republican Party and Romney are paying a guy to sabotage the vote makes the Republicans actually look like organized crime.
Well, thank you for bringing this up. I'm glad you brought it up. There are so many different aspects to this. And according to Talking Point's memo, Strategic Allied Consulting was paid more than $600,000 by Republican sources in September before being blacklisted for voter registration fraud. Peter Orotova, have you been following this?
I know some about it. It is true that Sproul is a repeat offender in this area, and it is really kind of mind-boggling that the Republicans again used his firm to do voter registration, knowing his track record from previous elections of, in fact, as the caller mentioned, being charged with throwing out the voter registration applications of Democrats. But this points to the larger problem of the voter registration system, as we've been talking about, and and also about the allegations of fraud that are being made out there. People are talking about fraud a lot to justify some of the restrictive types of laws that we've been talking about. When the types of restrictive laws they've been enacting would do nothing about something like this voter registration incident or other issues with the voter registration system that may be problematic. So we're stuck in this kind of time warp of, coming up with solutions that do nothing to solve the real problems and ignoring the real problems. Because this is all sort of being played out on a partisan battleground.
And Cynthia in Santa Cruz, we don't have time to take your call, but Cynthia wanted to talk about those 200 billboards in swing states that said voter fraud is a felony, 3.5 years and $10,000 fine. They are now being taken down, and they were posted mainly in low-income minority neighborhoods. Thank you for the call and that comment, Cynthia. We've got 30 seconds left. What would you change about the system, Peter, to ensure that more people vote?
I think I would try to rewrite it from scratch to actually make it less subject to fraud, especially the kind of fraud we were just talking about, and also to make it much easier and to have it all happen on election day.
Well, we'll keep track of the numbers. Again, we've got 217 million people in this country who are eligible to vote. 90 million actually voted in 2010. Atova Andrea Wang is author of The Politics of Voter Suppression, and Peter Levine is author of the forthcoming book, We Are the Ones We Have Been Waiting For, The Philosophy and Practice of Civic Renewal. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you for your many great emails and phone calls. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. What are the challenges of providing humanitarian aid? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Sophie Delaney, Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders, a 40-year-old organization that provides humanitarian assistance in more than 60 countries to people whose survival is threatened by violence, neglect, and catastrophe. What are the politics of humanitarian aid, and what role should humanitarian organizations play during armed conflicts? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.